I've just popped in for a chat. There's this young journalist says he wants to edit my memoirs. So I said I'd meet him here, at my club in Covent Garden. Have you seen him yet?
No.
Well, if he's not here, how about a song?
Yes!
My most celebrated ditty. It's a cautionary tale about codlins, or apples. You'll all join in, won't you?
Yes!
Excellent, come on then. Little old woman her living got by selling codlins hot, hot, hot. And this little woman who codlins sold, though her codlins were hot, she felt herself cold. So to keep herself warm, she thought it no sin to fetch for herself a quartern of
gin!
Oh, for shame! Right on in. That journalist here yet?
No!
Well, he's called Dickens, Mr. Charles Dickens. He'll never make anything of himself if he can't even turn up on time. Oh, well, not to worry. I'll tell you lot my stories instead. I first turned up just a week before Drury Lane's pantomime season was going to start on Friday the 18th of December, 1779. I tumbled into life in Stanhope Street, where lots of theatrical people had digs on account of its close proximity to the London theatres. My parents were both theatrical, in all senses of the word. My mother was a chorus girl in the Drury Lane Company, and my dad, well, he was what they used to call a ballet master, which meant he was a kind of dancer, pantomimist, and part-time choreographer, all rolled into one. He'd emigrated from Italy, having learned his craft, performing at fairs and markets as a travelling player, and his English was never very good, nor was his temper. They met at Drury Lane, but were never married, so I was what you might call an illegitimate child. Always a bit outside of polite society, never quite the gentleman, so it was somehow appropriate that I became a part of the illegitimate, low world of pantomime. There was a big age difference between my parents. When I was born, Dad was 65, some 40 years older than my mother. Well, you can imagine how that made the gossips' tongues wag, especially since everyone knew he had a second mistress who bore him another child in the very same month that I was born. And as if that wasn't enough, he was actually married to yet another woman with whom he already had four other children. For his dancing abilities, he'd earned the nickname Iron Legs. But his temper and his lust were equally strong. He was a very singular and eccentric man whose methods of instruction were brutal. His regular work meant our family were able to live a life of relative ease, but his pitiless punishments filled our lives with fear, not comfort. And I would run and hide rather than be beaten for the least misdemeanor. And it wasn't just me and my brother John who suffered. If children he trained at Astley's Circus misbehaved, he was known to imprison them in cages and thence draw them up into the roof above the stage. And there he would leave them swinging like petrified birds above a precipitous drop until they begged forgiveness and his rage subsided. Apart from my father's brutal lessons, I had little formal schooling, for I spent nearly all my time at the theatres where my parents were rehearsing or performing. I would sit and watch the carpenters, scene painters, stage crew and flymen. I would chat with the ladies in the wardrobe as they sewed and patched costumes and observe the dancers being put through their routines. All this fed my appetite for the theatre, but my real education was in performance. My first public appearance was at Sadler's Wells before I had reached my third birthday, and by the estimable age of four, I was appearing in the physically demanding role of the monkey in the Harlequinade, accompanying my father, who was playing clown. But as usual, whenever I failed him or whenever he thought I had, his correction was harsh. I'd been brought up to play all kinds of fantastic tricks for performance, so I suppose it was inevitable that I should fool around off the stage as much as on it. and often being incited to do so by the occupants of the green room, I used to skip and tumble about as much for their diversion as for that of the public. All this I carefully concealed from my father, for when he did happen to observe any of my pranks, he always administered the same punishment, a sound thrashing, which terminated in me being lifted up by the hair of my head and stuck in a corner, whence, with a severe countenance and awful voice, my father would say, "Venture to move at your peril." He was a profoundly melancholic man, with a lifelong terror and foreboding of death. He would regularly wander about local graveyards, speculating on the diseases from which the inhabitants had died. He would imagine their deathbeds and wonder how many of them might have been buried alive in some sort of fit or trance, a possibility which haunted him throughout his life. And when he finally died at the great age of 78, he left express directions in his will that before his coffin should be fastened down, his head should be severed from his body in the presence of several witnesses, to prove that old Iron Legs would dance no more. When it was done, I knew that I no longer needed to run or hide. I was 18 when I truly lost my heart. When rehearsing at Sadler's Wells, my mother would stay there all day, taking meals into the dressing room and occupying herself with needlework in order to avoid having to walk all the way home and back between rehearsals and shows. Now, at this time, Mr. Hughes was the principal proprietor of the theatre, whose eldest daughter was a Miss Maria Hughes. She had always been much attached to my mother and embraced every opportunity of being in her society. Well, knowing the hours she kept in the dressing room during the day, Miss Hughes would take her work and sit talking with her from 3 until 6. I would usually be there between 4 and 5, preparing to perform, and always took tea with Mother until the other female performers arrived for the evening show. In this way, an intimacy arose between Miss Hughes and I, which ultimately ripened, for me, into feelings of a somewhat warmer nature. I resolved that unless I could marry her, I would marry nobody and remain forever miserable. But I had no reason to suppose she entertained for me anything other than the sentiments usually felt towards the son of a good friend, and besides which, the difference of social station between us seemed an insurmountable obstacle to our marriage. These considerations made me as unhappy as could be. I ate little, slept less, and lost my spirits. A variety of symptoms that were not ideal for a patient who depended upon his powers of fun and comicality for any chance of fulfilling his amorous hopes. I resolved never to visit the ladies' dressing room further, and either to take tea before going to the theatre or not bother at all. But 2 weeks later, I happened to be in the theatre wardrobe for some particular articles of dress, when I found myself confronted and alone with Miss Maria Hughes. "Why, Joe, I haven't seen you for a fortnight. Where have you been hiding?" I made an effort to speak and got as far as,
"I'm not well,"
before she replied kindly, "Well, I can see you're not well. Pray tell me, what is the matter with you?" Well, although I made an effort to speak and look cheerful, I simply threw myself into a chair and burst into tears like a child, vainly endeavouring to stammer out a few words which were wholly unintelligible. Well, Miss Hughes tried to soothe me, which was most agreeable, except that Mrs. Lewis, the seamstress, suddenly entered, upon which I felt very ridiculous, jumped up, and ran away. A day or two later, I disclosed my affections for Miss Hughes to Mrs. Lewis, who instantly took upon herself the office of go-between and undertook to sound out Miss Hughes without delay. She encouraged me to write a letter expressing my feelings, which she then took for Miss Hughes to read. Whilst she did this in her private rooms, I was performing on the public stage. towards the conclusion of the first play of the evening, I heard somebody enter the Hughes' box. And there sat the object of all my anxiety. At last, the business of the stage called me to the front, exactly facing the box in which she sat. Our eyes met, and she nodded and smiled. Yes! Yes! And I was thrown into such a state of agitation that I've no idea how or whether I finished the scene. We married a year later, and as the century turned, our happiness was unbounded. My career as clown was soaring as I topped the bill at both Sadler's Wells and Drury Lane. Mariah and I cheerfully anticipated an addition to our joys as we expected our first baby, a legitimate child, conceived with love to a stable home, the prospect of which increased our happiness manyfold. But after a sickly pregnancy and many months of both hope and fear, and lingering changes from better to worse and back again. My wife, my dear darling Mariah, whom I loved from the start with so much truth and feeling, died in childbirth. She was just 25. I was desolate. The somersaults and grimaces, the tricks and witticisms and all those silly antics of a buffoon were rendered meaningless and void. Like some cheap trick, when the rug is pulled from beneath your feet and you're left sprawling and gawping like a clown. 2 nights after her death, I was to play the gravedigger in Hamlet. How comic. For a clown to stand waist deep in a make-believe grave, with one's wife and stillborn child lying unburied outside the theatre. How funny can you be when playmaking apes the pain of living and loss? Grimaldi became grim all day, but still makes you laugh at night. This was my life, which had only just started. For by now, I had reached the grand old age of 22.